At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
300 and something points up on the Dow, all because one economist used one very loaded word. Wall Street? Desperate? Nah. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday. It's the 28th of November today. And you can get all excited, too, if you want to. Heck, everybody within shouting distance of Wall Street did today. All because a guy named Donald Cohn gave a little speech this morning, one that might, just maybe might, have provided a clue about which way interest rates are headed. Cohn's the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, which means you know he chose his words carefully. So when Wall Street heard this sentence,
"These developments would require offsetting policy actions, other things equal,"
it was Katie Barr the door. Let me play it for you one more time to make sure you pick up on the word of the day.
"These developments would require offsetting policy actions, other things equal."
Cohn had been talking about the credit squeeze and a slowing economy and how the Fed might need to offset that with its policy actions. The market's translation of offset was pretty simple. The Fed's going to cut rates, right? Wall Street's euphoria was kind of funny, really, since Cohn spent most of his time talking about how bad things are.
"Heightened concerns about larger losses at financial institutions that are now reflected in markets have depressed equity prices and could induce more intermediaries to adopt a more defensive posture in granting credit, not only for house purchases but for other uses as well."
Two things to remember out of that piece of tape. The first is that last bit he said about intermediaries and a defensive posture. So far, the credit squeeze has been mostly limited to Wall Street and mortgages. What happens if car loans and credit cards all of a sudden are harder to get to? Number two, and as a way to set up a final comment from Mr. Cohn, repeat after me. No matter how high it goes, the stock market is not the economy.
"As the Federal Market Committee noted at its last meeting, uncertainties about the economic outlook are unusually high right now. In my view, these uncertainties require flexible and pragmatic policy making. Nimble is the adjective I used a few weeks ago in a speech."
Rate cut would be the phrase that everybody is banking on right now. What most people haven't been counting on lately is falling oil prices, but crude has bubbled down more than 7% this week. Crude closed at $90.62 a barrel today. OPEC has been making some noises about a production increase, but since it can be tough to figure out what makes the cartel tick, we've called somebody whose job it is to do just that, Craig Priddies, an oil analyst at the Eurasia Group. Greg, good to have you here.
Thanks.
There are some mixed signals coming out from OPEC, if you read the Wire copy this morning. What's your take on a possible production increase?
there are often mixed signals that come out before OPEC meetings. I'm of the opinion that they probably are going to increase by 500,000 barrels a day at the December 5th meeting.
How come?
It really is kind of a unilateral Saudi decision at this point. They're the only OPEC member that has any spare capacity left. Everyone else is producing at capacity. And they're worried about the inflationary and possible recessionary impacts in the U.S. economy and more broadly in the developed consumer economies that could eventually produce a whipsaw effect in demand that would drive prices down. So they want to avoid that.
Is 500,000 barrels a day a stretch for them, or could they pump out some more if they wanted to?
Their spare capacity right now is about 1.7 million barrels a day, but they do have the ability to raise production somewhat. It is a heavier, lower quality oil, though. It's not necessarily what the market needs right now, but I think they want to make a gesture to be able to tamp down prices.
How much are politics factoring in here? I mean, the Saudis were a big presence at the peace conference in Annapolis just yesterday. Are they aware of that relationship with the United States as they think about oil?
That is a big part of their decision making, and it's really on a couple of levels. One, they don't want to see policy responses in the U.S. that would eventually undermine demand for oil, you know, like increased fuel efficiency standards for automobiles and that sort of thing. But on another level, there's also the security relationship with the United States. They always want to stay, at least to some extent, in our good graces with oil prices because they're so dependent on us for their security in the Persian Gulf.
What's the actual supply situation? I mean, 500,000 barrels a day, if they do increase it at the meeting on the 5th of December, really it's a drop in the barrel, as it were.
Well, inventories have been coming down in the fall, so there is an argument that some additional supply is needed. They had increased production a little bit back in September. That was offset in the short term by some field maintenance that was being done in the UAE. So there is an argument the market needs a little bit more. It's not that tight. You do have another factor which is driving it, which is not a supply or demand fundamental, which is money fleeing from other asset classes as part of the subprime crisis. You know, money's coming out of structured debt instruments and going into commodities, and that's tending to drive up commodity prices.
One more question before I let you go, Greg. How closely are they paying attention to that thing that really has oil watchers over here all up in arms, $100 a barrel? Are they interested in the actual price?
The $100 barrel mark is psychologically important because of the headlines it would generate in the U.S. In particular and more broadly. And I think that it's important mainly as a political symbol that if oil hit $100 a barrel, people would be looking for someone to blame. And I don't think that's something that they're really anxious to have happen right now.
Greg Priddy covers oil for the Eurasia Group. Greg, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
It's a funny thing. Greg mentioned higher fuel economy standards a minute ago because Congress is close to requiring exactly that. The standards would be tucked into a huge energy package, which might see a vote as early as next week. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The deal would give automakers until 2020 to reach a fleet-wide average fuel economy of 35 miles per gallon. That's about a 10-mile-per-gallon boost over the current standard. And according to some experts, it could save more than 1 million barrels of oil a day, or about half of the U.S.'s imports from the Persian Gulf. That may seem like a lot, but UC Berkeley energy expert Dan Kamen says it's hardly revolutionary.
Making our vehicles 35 miles per gallon or more by 2020, when much of Europe is already at 35 miles per gallon today, is not even much of a catch-up step.
He says it's an even smaller step when you consider the drastic reductions in greenhouse gas emissions needed to avert the worst effects of global warming. Others are more forgiving. Washington energy lobbyist Scott Siegel says given the timing, it's a near miracle the fuel economy standards are even on the table.
Well, it's been said many times that politics is sort of the art of the possible. And this energy bill is a good reflection of that because there's not a whole lot that's possible this close to a presidential election year, this close to a lot of contentious debates on broader issues like global climate change.
Siegel says lawmakers are likely to sacrifice some of the more controversial parts of the energy bill. One is a plan to repeal $16 billion in oil industry tax breaks. Another would require utilities to generate 15% of their power from renewable energy sources. Siegel says what's left mirrors the type of energy bill President Bush said he would sign. He says some lawmakers are willing to make those sacrifices now in order to tackle broader legislation on global warming once the president leaves office. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The Dow, believe it or not, was the slacker on Wall Street today, up a mere 2.5%.
We'll have the details when we do the numbers. R.J. Reynolds joined in the stock market party today. Shares were up 1.4%, but the cigarette company's been taking some heat for its ads lately, specifically the ones targeting young women smokers. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio. Reynolds has announced it's going to stop advertising in newspapers and magazines next year.
Cigarette ads aim to be cutting edge. The latest RJ ads to raise eyebrows are for Camel No. 9, cigarettes targeted to young women and advertised in fashion magazines. Professor Stanton Glantz at the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education says the ads use stylized feminine images to attract new smokers.
It takes brilliant marketing to get people to poison themselves.
Glantz says he's pleased that the ads won't be in print, but he thinks RJ is just shifting its marketing to the internet and direct mail, where it can more effectively reach young eyeballs.
This isn't a concession by Reynolds at all.
Some lawmakers had been calling for a ban on cigarette print ads, but the company stopped short of saying it made the decision to appease them. Here's R.J. Reynolds spokeswoman Jan Smith.
Tobacco social issues are a factor in every single business decision we make, but this decision is really driven by what we think is the best approach for our marketing programs in 2008.
Tobacco print ads were on the wane anyway. According to TNS Media Intelligence, R.J. Reynolds spent $52 million in advertising in 2006, but just over $13 million of that was spent on newspaper and magazine ads. Nat Ives, with Advertising Age, says R.J. Reynolds won't suffer from the decision.
For one thing, they're going to shift their marketing to other sort of platforms and circles and strategies.
Maybe the new approach is already working. Smoking had been on the decline in the U.S., but for the past few years, it's been steady. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The Hollywood writers' strike has gone global. European movie and TV writers threw up their own temporary pickets in London, Paris, and Berlin today. Back home, the strike is 4 weeks old this week. Both sides have gone back to the negotiating table. They're talking the talk. But some writers may be ready to stop walking the walk. Late night host Carson Daly is breaking ranks with Jay, Dave, and Conan. He's going back to work on Monday, deal or no deal, and he's asked non-union writers to give him some material. Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Welcome to the show. What a
A2 Daily? Actually, Carson Daly isn't a member of the Writers Guild, but having Last Call back on the air is a blow to the writers, especially if the show hires scabs. Hollywood Today columnist Alex Ben Block says Daly's not exactly a late-night ratings king, but if this entices bigger stars to follow, he says, it would spell disaster for the writers.
It would send a strong signal to others in the community who want to go back to work that they can get away with it. It might put a crack in the whole operation.
Block says we're not there yet, but if the dispute doesn't get resolved soon, it will likely drag into next year. L.A. economist Jack Kaiser says that could cost Los Angeles as much as $20 million a day and inflict permanent damage on the business.
In the 1988 Writers Guild strike, you had several series that were very, very badly damaged. The example that everybody uses is Moonlighting. And it did not recover from that strike. The show went off the air.
Not a happy prospect for studios shelling out millions of dollars per episode for shows like Ugly Betty and Lost. Still, Alex Ben Block says these days, studios are just small parts of enormous conglomerates like GE, not their bread and butter.
They can take a 4, 6, 8 week strike and it's not going to matter much to them. Whereas to the writers, every day counts.
Still, Block points out that if the strikes start impacting quarterly profits, studios will be looking for a happy ending fast. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, Chinese kids struggle to slim down.
If I don't lose weight, people will tease me that I'm fat. They won't vote for me because they think I work too slow.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial soared 2.5% today, 331 points to close at 13,289. The Nasdaq climbed more than 3.1%, 82 points to close at 2662. The S&P 500 rocketed up 2.2%, 37 points to end the day at 1466. The love affair with Citigroup is back on again. The financial giant shot up more than 6.5% today. Strong forecasts for online retailers bid up shares of eBay 3.75%. Shares of both Ford and General Motors revved to gains of more than 4% overall. Markets overseas were kind of mixed. Back home, bond prices were lower. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.03%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home sales for October. They're calling it the mortgage mess. The Consumer Federation of America talks about that and other money topics at its annual financial services conference. And what do you think about salt? The FDA solicits your comments tomorrow at a hearing on their policies regarding sodium in food. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Senate is back to work on Monday after its Thanksgiving Day holiday. At some point, a concept called retroactive immunity is going to come up in debate. The Senate is scheduled to take up its most recent version of the electronic surveillance bill. This one would give telecommunications companies immunity from lawsuits over wiretaps going back as far as September 11th, 2001. Commentator Robert Reich says that's a bad idea.
You think anyone who remembered J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and Nixon's CIA and the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, let alone the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, might be concerned about the government illegally snooping on Americans. But executives at the nation's biggest telecoms didn't blink an eye when the NSA, America's biggest spy agency, came knocking. You want records of domestic phone calls? Oh, sure. Help yourself. Emails? Oh, yeah, we got tons. They're yours. When word of this leaked out and the companies got sued by Americans who didn't particularly like the idea of government rummaging through everything they said or wrote, the telecoms went to Congress and complained. It wasn't their fault. They deserved immunity from such lawsuits. They were only following orders. Only following orders? What if the government had told telecoms to use their technologies to spy on American bedrooms, or turn over our bank accounts, or our personal photographs, or home videos, or anything else we store on computers, or transmit through cables, or over the Internet? The only following orders excuse would make telecoms extensions of our spy agencies. Corporate executives have a duty to disobey government orders when they have reason to believe those orders are illegal or unconstitutional, and make the government go to court to get what it wants. The duty to refuse is especially important when it comes to the nation's telecoms, whose technological reach is extending deeper and deeper into our private lives. Sure, there's a delicate balance between fighting terrorism and protecting civil liberties, but that's for courts to decide, not spy agencies and not telecom executives. If in doubt, the telecoms can go to the special courts set up precisely to oversee this balance and get a declaratory judgment. Yet the only way to keep pressure on them to do this and not become agents of our spy agencies is to continue to allow Americans to sue them for violating their legal rights.
Robert Reich was the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His latest book is called Super Capitalism. You can send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. The Securities and Exchange Commission threw a dose of cold water on the shareholder rights movement today. It formally approved as a rule a guideline that it's been following for a long time now, one that makes it harder for shareholders to nominate their own candidates to corporate boards of directors. Advocates want investors to have more of a say in who runs the companies they own, and so they pressured the SEC to put off today's vote because its Democratic commissioners are leaving. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The SEC normally has four commissioners, two from each party. The chair belongs to the president's party. That makes it hard for the commission to tilt too much in favor of big business or investors. But one Democratic commissioner quit this fall, and the other will be gone soon. That will leave an all-GOP commission in place, possibly until next spring. That's drawn the attention of congressional Democrats.
Let me call the hearing to order today.
At a recent Senate hearing, New Jersey Democrat Robert Menendez wondered if SEC Chairman Christopher Cox was favoring big business. He said Cox was ramming through the shareholders' rule the SEC voted on today.
Why this rush on such a complex and yet important issue?
Chairman Cox replied he wanted to get the vote out of the way before annual shareholders meetings start next year because investors need stability.
The uncertainty is palpable.
Besides, Cox said, he'll have the SEC revisit the issue this spring when two new Democrats should be on board. In the meantime, of course, the SEC will have to keep working. The Democratic commissioner who left in September, Roel Campos, says Chairman Cox does try to be fair. Still,
there will continue to be a perception on divisive issues that the commission wasn't in its best position to render the best decision, and therefore those types of rulemakings will be subject to more attack.
Campos thinks lawsuits are coming. Lawyers for investors are likely to argue that decisions taken by an incomplete commission aren't valid. Columbia University law professor John Coffey says this is the most partisan atmosphere at the SEC in half a century.
Now we're getting to issues that tend to pit institutional investors on one side and business community and management on the other, and that turns into a Republican versus Democrat split, and there have not been compromises.
Those issues are piling up. There are cases involving backdated stock options. The commission also has to decide whether to adopt international accounting rules. They can be weaker than U.S. regulations. So does this mean the SEC will overtly favor big business? Former SEC Chairman Arthur Levitt says no, and here's why.
You can't suddenly wage a war against investors or against the business community. The process is subject to oversight. The process is subject to public scrutiny by the media. That sort of thing is not likely to happen.
Maybe nothing will happen. The SEC could put off these difficult decisions until someone new moves into the White House. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There is one more regulatory story to update you on. We told you Monday the Federal Communications Commission was set to tighten the rules for the cable industry. That didn't happen. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin couldn't round up the votes he needed in the face of lobbying by those cable companies. Congratulations of a sort are in order. The Centers for Disease Control reported today American obesity rates are leveling off. Still, it's not a pretty picture. About a third of all adults in this country, men and women, are obese. And as in so many other things, China is gaining on us. Rising childhood obesity rates there are a side effect of rapid economic development. They're historically predictable, but Beijing's answer to it, not so predictable. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Everybody boogie. That's the new mandate this year for every Chinese school kid, K through 12. At Shanghai's Hong Kong No. 3 Elementary School, a couple hundred third graders are bopping to the beat on the schoolyard grass. It's part square dance, part karaoke, part free-for-all. The government's not laughing, though, about slimming kids down. One in four children in big cities like Shanghai is obese. In the past two decades, the percent of very fat kids has quadrupled. This slightly pudgy 9-year-old sounds determined to avoid that fate.
When fat people dance, they sweat so they can lose weight.
She's working off the pounds to get elected school president.
If I don't lose weight, people will tease me that I'm fat. They won't vote for me because they think I work too slow.
In developing countries, child obesity goes hand in hand with rapid growth. China's numbers are still a fraction of, say, America's. But since China's economy has gone from 0 to 60 so quickly, the epidemic has spiked out of nowhere. A big reason? Diet changes. James Rice of Tyson Foods has worked in China since the 80s.
20 years ago, if you went to a Chinese person's home as a guest, the snacks they would put out on the table to receive a guest, it would have been hot tea and then seeds or vegetables, fruit and nuts. And of course, these were the only choices in China in those days.
Today, when you visit that Chinese host, you get
Coca-Cola, 7-Up, Pringles, potato chips, Frito-Lay snacks, and these kind of sort of processed foods.
Chinese kids nowadays have fewer chances to burn off those bad calories. Hans Truesen of the World Health Organization says more and more children live in modern cities that are a bit too comfy.
They are less likely to do exercise. They might go by motorbike or cars instead of walking or going by bicycles.
In the U.S., obese kids tend to come from poorer families. It's the other way around in China, where elite kids get pushed by their elite parents to study, i.e., sit on their bottoms.
They have less time for playing games and for physical exercise, need to do much more studying, often have access to computers, which limit their time to do other things.
And this is a generation of only children because of the one-child policy. Translation, spoiled. Third-grade parent Chen Gang.
My brother's kids, they live with their parents and grandparents on the same roof. So the kids are little emperors. Whatever they want, they get, so they eat too much junk food.
Mr. Chen's public enemy number one, French fries. As part of its shape-up policy, Beijing has picked song and dance routines for the different age groups. Middle schoolers get down to this number. And high school teenagers waltz. The forced dancing isn't just for losing weight. It's also meant to help China's only children improve their social skills. But critics quoted in state media fear it'll encourage members of the opposite sex to develop, quote, curious feelings. It doesn't seem a problem at this school, where good old-fashioned cooties talk is alive and well.
This boy in our class, no one wants to dance with him because he has bad breath.
The third-grade boy next to her then retorts with a crack about those stinky, stinky girls. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, a reminder that what Uncle Sam giveth, Uncle Sam can taketh away. Federal employees are in line for a 2.5% pay raise come January 1st, and that's not going to change. But workers who live in more expensive cities like New York and Washington won't be getting an extra 12.5% bump the law provides for. Today, the White House cut that extra pay to just 0.5%. The president called the differential an unacceptably high cost to the nation. Total tab would have been almost $13 billion, which the president said would interfere with the war on terrorism. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow jumped 331 points on a speech by a Federal Reserve official, 2.5% there. The NASDAQ bumped up 82 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 sailed forward 37 points, that is 2.2%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, and Aaron Scott engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, did you ever wonder how the CEO of eBay bids on an auction?
I say, here's the most amount I'm willing to pay, and then I let the system bid for me. And sometimes I win, and sometimes I don't.
Meg Whitman in another Conversation from the Corner Office. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.